Welcome to the Physics 123 lecture for April 3rd, 2013. You can find the slides that accompany this lecture on the class website. Just a reminder, exam 2 is looming large, April 11th, Dewey 1101, 8 in the morning. It will be up to the start of Bohr's model of the atom, which is what we started talking about in the April 1st lecture. There'll be lots of this crazy optics stuff and formulas, so this time you can use both sides of your 8.5 by 11 inch sheet of paper for notes and formulas. I will also provide a formula sheet as well. By the time you get this, I should have sent an email to you about the exam material coverage. Go to slide 2. Last time we talked about the Bohr model of the atom, and this is what you might think of as the simplest nuclear model that you can come up with. Nuclear meaning that the massive positive charge in the nucleus is all at the center of the atom, and it's very compact compared to the basic size of the atom. In this model, the electron is held in the atom by the Coulomb force. It moves in circular orbits, and only discrete stable orbits are allowed. And Bohr has his way of doing this. He quantized angular momentum. We've learned about de Broglie's idea that the electron might be a wave, and in fact, you can get the same quantization by demanding that as this electron wave goes around a given circle, that it adds to itself constructively. So if you demand effectively circular standing waves, then you get quantization of these orbits. So it actually, de Broglie's work motivates the Bohr model a bit. So photons, quantized light, are emitted or absorbed as the electron moves from one orbit to another. So electrons in, if the electron is in a low energy orbit, it can absorb a photon and then move to a high energy orbit, or vice versa. And the photon energy is exactly the difference in energy between those two orbits. So this was another important thing that Bohr did, was he took this whole idea of the photon and used it in a way that they now interact with the atom, and between the discrete orbits and this idea of the photons, he was able to produce discrete energy levels and discrete. He was able to say that a given atom is going to emit only certain frequencies of light or discrete spectra, which, of course, is what he was really after. So I write on the left-hand side an expression for the quantized circular orbit radii, where n is an integer, h bar. K is the K you have in Coulomb's law. Z is the charge on the nucleus. And then E is the charge of the electron. And then you have the mass of the electron. I also have the energy of the various states written down. And again, both of these are quantized. You should know how to derive these. I'm not going to do it again here. We did it on the April 1st lecture explicitly. It's relatively simple to derive them. You use classical centripetal force is equal to the Coulomb force, and then you need to figure out how to think your way through putting in the quantization and then carrying that through. I think the Bohr model is relatively simple, and it's a valuable model to know, so I'd like you to be able to derive that when you get around to studying for, I guess this would be on the final. For slide 3, one thing I actually forgot to say last time is one of the reasons the Bohr model is important is it basically works. I mean, one can't really get the discrete spectra very easily in classical physics, but you can get The Bohr model more or less will give you the spectra of the hydrogen atom. So it works pretty well for the light and the for a single electron atom. And it wasn't the last say in these sort of semi-classical models. In order to try to improve things, the spectra weren't perfect, but it was pretty close. But to try to improve things, people allowed the electron to have elliptical orbits. They instead of having the nucleus fixed, you allow the nucleus to move a little bit, so the nucleus and the electron would both orbit the center of mass, etc. So there were improvements made to the Bohr model. And all in all, it was very valuable because it got people to take the nuclear atom very seriously, because it was certainly successful enough at giving you something that was close to what we were seeing in the lab that people had to take very seriously. It also related the quantity of light and the quantization of the atomic energy levels, which is a new thing. So this is very valuable. I also think, in some ways, the Bohr model is not a bad starting place for your intuition about atoms. But the Bohr model isn't perfect. It really does fail to describe the spectra, especially the larger atoms and atoms where you have multiple electrons in them. It's a bit of a mixed bag because, on the one hand, you're treating the electron classically, and on the other hand, the quantization is actually very nicely motivated if you think of the electron as a wave. So it's sort of a semi-classical treatment. And it is by no means perfect. People were very good at spectroscopy at the time this stuff was being developed, and the Bohr model predictions weren't perfect. There were some effects that it didn't include at all. So what we really need to have a good model of the atom is an atom where we have a consistent theory that treats the electron as a wave from the grounds up. And that's basically what quantum mechanics does. So we'll come back to the atom, and for now, what I want to do is to talk a bit more about the development of quantum mechanics. So, this whole idea that particles are waves actually leads to a pretty strange new world. And maybe it'll sneak up on you a little bit. We've been dealing with waves quite a bit. And as you see on slide 5, you remember that we can describe waves in terms of position space or in terms of spatial frequency. And we can move between these two modes of description, for example, using Fourier analysis. And remember that when we were looking at Fourier analysis, and this is the reason that I dragged you through that, if the wave that you're trying to describe has fine structure and position, or if it's a very narrow wave packet, that is, your knowledge about where that wave is, or if you're is very good, okay, then it takes higher and higher frequencies in the Fourier analysis to describe that wave. You have to, the Fourier sum that describes that sharp wave, the relative importance of the higher frequency components becomes much greater. So, similarly, if you describe the wave in terms of time, for example, it's a wave packet that passes very fast or something, if you wish, you can describe it in terms of time, or you can describe describe it in terms of temporal frequency. So, similarly, these two were related to each other in Fourier analysis. So I can try to say this mathematically down at the bottom of slide 5 by basically saying that the width and position space for the wave times its width and frequency space, if you were doing a Fourier analysis of it, they're inversely proportional to one another. That is, if I make the wave narrower, I require more frequencies to describe it. Similarly, if the wave is narrow in time, I require higher temporal frequencies to describe it. So let's go to slide 6. So now let's think of matter as a wave, or a particle as a wave. De Bruijs says a particle has a momentum that's h over lambda. We can rewrite lambda in terms of k. So momentum is equal to hk over 2 pi. And then I want to rewrite the h over 2 pi as a quantity which we call h bar. So it's the h with a little bar across it. That's nothing more than h over 2 pi. But you'll see it often. So the momentum is equal to h bar k, according to de Bruijs. So if we say that a wave has a width in spatial frequency space, or k space, delta k, then we're saying that it has a width in momentum space, delta p over h bar. So this delta x times delta k is roughly equal, goes roughly as 1, can be rewritten as delta x times delta p over h bar is roughly 1, or delta x times delta p is roughly h bar. There's sort of a limiting case. It's often written as delta x times delta p is less than h bar. Sorry, I think I got that backwards. Has to be greater than h bar. So what it says is that if you have a wave, if you're describing a particle as a wave, then your knowledge of where that particle is, which I'll describe as delta x, is basically limited to be sort of the width of the wave. That is inversely proportional to the description in momentum space of the particle in the same way that we've been talking about for regular waves. So what it says is that if you localize the position of a particle to something very small, then your knowledge of its momentum is very poor. And vice versa. There's a similar form, E equals H nu. I can rewrite H nu as H bar omega. So delta omega is delta E over H bar. And what we find is the lower expression circled in red, delta T times delta E, goes as H bar. So what this says is, for example, if a particle is very localized in time, that is, it, say, has a very short lifetime, for example, then we don't know its energy very well. If it has a very well-known energy, then it has a long lifetime. These things that I've circled in red are two forms of what is known as Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And they really follow from the fact that for waves, you can describe things in position or frequency or time and frequency space, and that your knowledge of those two are sort of inversely proportional to one another. But it really leads to a lot of weirdness. If we go to slide 7, remember that in a world of particles, in Newton's world, everything you learned in physics 121 or 141, what you learned was that if I had a big computer and I could write down in that computer, if I knew the position and the momentum and the forces on every particle in the universe, I could predict the future exactly. If you just want to think about a single particle, if I know where it is, if I know what its momentum is, and I know how that momentum is changing, that is, I know what the force is that's on it, I can tell you what will happen to that particle in the future. So what this means is, in the Newtonian world, the universe is entirely deterministic. And, you know, in a sense, physicists have every reason to be arrogant, because basically they figured out a way to determine the future. And really, you're just limited by your computing power, if you want to think of it that way. But the moment you say that particles are waves, all this goes out the window, right? I can no longer, the better I know the position of the particle, the less I know its momentum. The better I know its momentum, the less I know its position. I cannot know them both simultaneously. Therefore, there's inherent uncertainty built into the system. And it's sort of sad if you think about it. The minute you say that particles are waves, we lose the deterministic universe. So I think that it's something one should shed tears over. Let's go to slide 8. So we should mourn the loss of the deterministic universe. But having said that, I hope that I will have enough time in this semester to give you a sense of what one can do with this uncertainty, because it turns out that the uncertainty that you get within quantum mechanics also gives you sort of a totally new freedom. So let me just paint how strange the world is. It's almost Harry Potter-ish, some of the things that you can do with this uncertainty in physics. Okay, let me just give you one little taste of it. Suppose I have a box, and within that box I've fully evacuated it. We have nothing but empty space. What does Newton say you have there? You have nothing but empty space. How boring is that? It's utterly boring. Let's go to slide 9. Now think about it. Let us consider this little bit of empty space, and let us consider it over a very, very short time. If we are considering it over a very, very short time, what Heisenberg's uncertainty principle tells us is that we have much uncertainty in the energy. And in fact, you can have within this bit of space that you're considering over an extremely short time, you can have fluctuations in the energy that are consistent with the Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Those fluctuations in energy may be enough energy to actually create particle-antiparticle pairs in the vacuum. Those pairs will then annihilate and go away in a short time, so they're not observable indirectly, because otherwise you'd be violating Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, because you can't have them hang out that long if the uncertainty in the energy is very large. So this changes entirely our whole concept of the vacuum. It's not nothing. The vacuum is a seething mess, a big sea of seething particle and antiparticle pairs over very short time scales. And you may think, I mean, look, I'm not standing in front of you because of the way we're doing this lecture, but if I'm standing, suppose I was standing in front of you, I could look at you straight in the eye and say, I just made a Volvo appear out of thin air and then it disappeared. And you were none the wiser, because it happened over such a very short time that you couldn't see it. And you might think, well, that's sort of silly. It's semantics. Who cares? It turns out that it's important, because these kinds of things that quantum mechanics allows to happen actually are things that you have to consider when you calculate the probabilities and make calculations in quantum mechanics. And it turns out that they're very important and can lead to really some absolutely phenomenal effects. So these fleeting pairs in this particular discussion we call virtual particles. And, they're certainly very fleeting, but they can make observable effects. So we're going to come back to this. So quantum mechanics really opens up a lot of strange Harry Potterish possibilities that are extremely powerful and have driven this uncertainty principle has actually driven much of the scientific advances in the last century. Certainly, it's extremely important in all of our models about particle physics and cosmology and everything. So we're going to come back to this. It's really a fabulous new freedom, in spite of the fact that we've lost the deterministic universe. I think it's a net gain. So let's go to slide 10. So what I'd like to do is to really talk about quantum mechanics. And what do we mean when we say quantum mechanics? Quantum mechanics really is the mechanics that allows us to calculate the motion of a particle, which is described in a wave equation, under the influence of a force. What we typically will say, the particle is moving in a potential. So that's maybe a little bit lingo, but I want you to recall that the force in a given direction is minus the derivative of the potential energy function in that direction. Or in 3D, the force is minus the gradient of the potential. So that's why when you think of a particle that has a force on it, and you will in time just begin to say it's in a potential. So the first thing you might ask, as I've written in the middle of slide 10, why not use the same old wave equation we've been using? Waves are waves, right? So what's the deal? Well, that wave equation works. It's a traveling wave, but it doesn't have a force on it. So it doesn't include a potential that is exerting a force on the particle. And this equation isn't necessarily consistent with what we already know to be true in quantum mechanics, which is E equals H nu and P is equal to H over lambda. So we need to build in that consistency. It needs to work for that type of wave. So we want that consistency. The other thing is we want to include a potential. So at the bottom of the slide, you see that if we have energy conservation, including potential, basically is the energy is equal to the kinetic energy, which I've written as P squared over 2m, plus the potential energy, which I'm just writing as V here. Another thing that's important to have, which is shared by the equation in the middle of page 10, but it's important to keep in place as we develop this new wave equation. It needs to be linear in psi, whatever the function is that describes the wave, because if it's linear, then you're allowed to satisfy superposition, which is something that we don't want to give up. In fact, we already know that we have to have it because we have electron diffraction, for example. So go to slide 11. All right, so let's try to motivate this thing. Look where I have a blue A in a circle. So we have E is equal to H bar omega and P is equal to K H bar. So this is basically what we already know about quantum mechanics as input. Then we want to feed this expression for energy and momentum into the energy conservation equation we had at the bottom of the last slide. And when we do, we get the expression where I have the blue C in a circle. H bar omega is equal to K squared H bar squared over 2m plus V. So Now, for simplicity, why don't we just assume that the particle is a one-dimensional wave, has amplitude 1 for simplicity. So you might think, okay, knowing everything we know about waves, maybe the simplest wave function we could write down would be written where I have a blue D in a circle, psi of x and t is equal to e to the I kx minus omega t. So if we take that as our psi, then, and we want in the end to have the expression where I have the blue C in a circle to hold true, then it turns out an equation that works is written where I have a blue E in a circle. And then if we multiply by I over I, and you can satisfy yourself, so you can take that psi and you can take the derivative with respect to time. And hold on a second, I just discovered an error in what I had written, so I have to fix it. And you can take the second derivative of psi with respect to position. You can plug those things in to where we have the blue E in a circle, and you can see that it works. So anyway, if we multiply that equation by I over I, we get the equation that's circled in red at the bottom. IH bar times the first derivative with respect to time of the wave function is equal to minus h bar squared over 2m times the second derivative of psi with respect to position plus the potential function times psi. And this, my friends, is the one-dimensional, non-relativistic, time-dependent Schrodinger equation. And this then is the wave equation that we were looking for, or at least one form of it. So let's go to slide 12. Just as an aside, two of the big players' names you'll hear, we've already heard actually, Heisenberg and Schrodinger are pictured here. Actually, these two guys both basically developed quantum mechanics. They did it rather differently. Heisenberg's formulation was sort of a matrix formulation that was very formal and I think not incredibly intuitive. Schrodinger came up with some sort of the wave mechanics, which is what you typically will see and learn. And I think it's more intuitive, especially based on all the wave stuff that we have out of classical physics. The two approaches are equivalent, actually, it turns out. So both these guys won Nobel Prizes in successive years, and we have a lot to thank them for. All right, so let's go to slide 13. All right, so I've written on the upper left-hand corner Schrodinger's one-dimensional, time-dependent, non-relativistic equation. Okay, and you look at this mess and you go, well, what do I do with that? Well, I think it will make sense when we do some examples, and we'll do examples shortly, but I'm going to go ahead and keep pushing on the theory. What you do is you have some physical situation that your particle is moving through. So your particle is represented by this wave function, and you describe that physical situation by putting in whatever the function is for the potential. Okay, it could be a 1 over r potential, would be like gravity, or the Coulomb force. It could be some other sort of mathematical potential. And so depending on what you put in for v, then you get different solutions to this equation. And in the end, what you're trying to do is to solve for whatever this psi is and perhaps what the energies are, etc. So that's the basic idea. But let me keep plugging a little, and we'll, I promise we'll do some examples. This is a time-dependent equation. We could imagine that it's useful in many instances to have static situation where the potential does not vary in time. So I'm going to have the potential, which earlier was a function of x and t, just simplify to v of x, constant in time. And we're going to say that the wave function, which may depend on x and t, is actually separable into a piece that depends only on x and a piece that depends only on time. And now I'm going to take these assumptions and put them into the time-dependent equation that we have up above. So the left-hand term becomes minus ih bar times the partial derivative of psi of x times psi of t, or the partial derivative of the psi x psi t combination with respect to time. I should probably just not say all of this too. The second term, again, you substitute in the new form for psi. And for the potential term, the right-hand term in the upper left equation, note that v is now simplified to just v of x, and we have psi, again, as broken into its separate pieces. So if we go to the equation at the bottom, for the left-hand derivative, it's a derivative with respect to time, so the spatial part of the wave function just pulls through. Similarly, in the first term on the right-hand side, the temporal part of the wave function pulls through the second derivative with respect to position. Go to slide 14. Now, let's divide through by psi of x times psi of t, and you get the equation that I have at the top of equation 14. Note that the left-hand side now is entirely just a function of time, and the right-hand side is entirely just a function of position. This equality can only hold true for all positions in time if each of these are equal to the same constant. So they have to each be equal to a constant, and they have to be equal to the same constant, or this equality can't hold true. And this is actually standard procedure for differential equations, separation of variables. If you've done that yet, you probably recognize what we're doing. So both sides have to be equal to a constant for this to be true. Let's choose it to be E, which will turn out to be the energy, right? So at the bottom of slide 14, let's look at the left-hand side. We set it equal to E, and we get the equation that I have where we have a blue A in a circle. And certainly one solution of this would be psi of t is equal to e to the minus ie over h bar times t. Do the derivative and prove it to yourself. The right-hand side for the equation at the top of slide 14 gives us what we have where I have the blue b in a circle at the bottom. So we set that whole side equal to E again. Now go to slide 15. Remember way back when we said that our little one-dimensional wave might have the form of E to the ikx minus omega t. And now we've said, and note that if we have it in that form, in fact, it is separable into a position piece and a time piece, as I have written at the top of slide 15. Psi of xt is equal to e to the ikx times e to the minus I omega t. And, of course, if we recall that in our quantum mechanical picture, e is equal to h bar omega, we can substitute in for omega, and we get that psi of xt is equal to some position piece times e to the minus I e over h bar times t. So that basically shows you how the time piece factors out of the wave function. And then if we go to the bottom of page 14 and take the equation that we have on the lower right-hand side, I rewrite it again at the bottom of page 15. And I just multiply through by psi of x, and you get the equation that I have circled in red at the bottom of slide 15. And note now, this equation depends only on space. So this is the time-independent, one-dimensional, non-relativistic Schrodinger equation. So it is... Schrodinger has two forms, the time-dependent and the time-independent, that we may use. So let's go to slide 16. Woohoo! All right, you got wave equations. So what's so hard about this, right? Well, think about it. What's actually waving? What is psi? Worse than that, if you look, or maybe not worse, but also, if you look in the middle of slide 15, we have this expression for psi. It's complex, and I don't mean complex as in difficult. I mean complex as in you have this square root of minus 1. You have an I in there. So it's really hard to associate complex things to the real world because it's not a real number. It's not a real quantity. So this whole idea of what is psi is really a bit bizarre. We now have wave equations that are consistent with the ideas of quantum mechanics that we're feeding into it. We have wave equations that are linear in psi. But what is psi? For all the other waves, you have a mechanical thing waving, or in the case of electromagnetism, you have E and B doing the waving. And in all these cases, these are real things that are changing. So Max Born, in 1926, came up with what's called the Born interpretation of psi. And I don't know what psi is. I don't guess anybody really does. It's hard to... We can't associate it really with anything physical if it's just psi. However, what Born said is the square of psi. Remember, the square of the psi gets rid of the complex piece. And he says that represents the particle, the probability density for the particle or the wave. So if we go to slide 17, Born's postulate in detail says at some time t, the complex conjugate of psi times psi itself times dx, which we can rewrite as I have at the top of page 17 as the absolute value of psi squared, times dx. That quantity gives you the probability of finding the particle between x and x plus dx. Okay, so the psi square is a probability density, and if I multiply it by the region in which I want to find it, I get the probability of finding the particle there. So the particle has to be somewhere, so that means there's a normalization that we have that the total probability has to be 1, which means if I integrate over all space in the problem, so if it's a one-dimensional problem, if I integrate from minus infinity to infinity for x, if it's a three-dimensional problem, I have to integrate over all space. If I integrate psi square over all space or that's available in the problem, that quantity has to be equal to 1. So this is a normalization condition. It's a constraint on any problem that you do, and you can use it to help you solve for some aspect of psi. And we'll see that when we get to examples. So let's go to slide 18. All right. I guess we have reached the point where I can now do a couple of examples. So let's start with the simplest example we can, which is, let's just say we have a free particle. Okay, we have no forces on it. So that means the time-independent Schrodinger equation becomes what we have where I've written a blue A in a circle. So I've really done nothing but rewrite the time-independent Schrodinger equation, and we allow the potential function V go to zero. And now we have the psi of XT form that we saw on slide 15. Why don't we just use it? Let's just try it as a solution. And in fact, when you plug that psi into the equation where V is equal to zero, it actually is a solution so long as K is equal to the square root of 2ME over H bar squared. So notice we have this particular form of psi that we're proposing, and then we solve the equation, and out of that pops a constraint onto K and E and how they're related. So let's go to slide 19. Well, if you look back on slide 18, remember now we've got, if you look at what psi of xt is, right, that's a wave that's traveling in the positive x direction. So if we look at the fact that this solved the equation, if e to the ikx solves it, e to the minus ikx will also solve it. So that means the wave that travels in the minus x direction is also a solution to this problem. So in the middle of slide 19, that means our general solution, psi, as a function of x, is equal to a times e to the ikx plus b times e to the minus ikx, because both e to the ikx and e to the minus ikx are solutions to this equation. And in both cases, the k squared is equal to 2me over h bar squared. So there is this relationship between the wave number and the energy. We could write this equivalently as psi of x is equal to some constant times sine kx plus some constant times cosine of kx with the same constraint on k and e. If that's not obvious to you, I want you to study page 20. Remember Euler's formula. We found that we could rewrite cosine theta as e to the I theta plus e to the minus I theta over 2, and sine theta we could rewrite as e to the I theta minus e to the minus I theta over 2. So let's suppose we start with I'll call it A prime, sine kx plus B prime cosine kx, and I rewrite the sine and the cosine in terms of Euler's formula. Then I can regroup terms, and you can see that I end up with something that's equal to a constant times e to the ikx plus another constant times e to the minus ikx. So if you go to the bottom of slide 19, we could write the solution to this free particle either of the ways that we've written in the bottom of slide 19, either in terms of the complex exponentials or in terms of harmonic functions. And you may think, well, okay, that's annoying, granted. But it turns out that when you're solving problems, depending on how the problem is set up, sometimes you'll find that expressing the wave function in terms of one of these ways or the other way, one or the other of these, makes the problem make a lot more sense and be easier to solve. So it's just sort of for mathematical convenience, you may choose one or the other. So let's go to slide 21. Oh, that's a new example. Maybe before we move on, let's just sort of go back up to slide 19 just for a second. I mean, we solved the problem, right? We now have a wave function, and what came out of that is a constraint on how the energy and the wavelength are related. Okay. which is this k squared is equal to 2me over h bar squared. So, I admit, that's not overly exciting, but we will have particles that are free in many of the problems that we have, and when we have a particle that's free, we'll come back to this and use this information that we have. Basically, you'll know what its energy is, you'll know what its wave function is in that region where it's free. And now, I'll illustrate that by doing another example, and this one will be the one-dimensional particle in a box, starting on page 21. Or you might call this an infinite square well potential problem. So the idea here is that we have a potential function that is infinite everywhere along the x-axis. We're going to do a one-dimensional problem. It's infinite everywhere on the x-axis except between 0 and L, and in that region the potential is 0. Okay? So a way to think about it is the minus the gradient of the potential is infinite at 0 and L. So if a particle, for example, is moving to the right, when it gets to L, there's an infinite force, basically, and it cannot penetrate any further. And if it's going the other way, it can't penetrate past 0. So the particle is constrained to be in this square well potential. It cannot move outside the region 0 to L. So if we want to describe the wave function is just 0 in the regions where we have infinite potential, because it makes no sense otherwise, because the potential is infinite. So Schrodinger's equation makes no sense when you have an infinite potential. So psi is simply 0 there. So what that means is inside the region 0 to L, the potential is 0 now. By definition, that's how it's set up in the problem. And so we say that within that region, the particle acts like a free particle. It's inside the box. So in this particular case, because we have these sharp edges where we know that the wave function goes to zero, it turns out that I'd like to describe the particle between 0 and L using the free particle wave function, but I want to use the form with the harmonic functions instead of the complex exponentials. So on the right-hand lower part of slide 21, that will be the wave function that we will have in the region between 0 is less than x is less than L. Psi of x is equal to A sine kx plus B cosine kx. I'm not telling you anything yet about k. I'm not telling you anything about A and B. So there's a lot we don't know about this, but this is the form that we have because we know that that's the form that a free particle wave function takes. So if we go to slide 22, now the way to solve the problem is to now use the boundary conditions in the problem in order to constrain the solution. So for example, at x equals 0, we know that the wave function has to go to 0 because it's 0 beyond x, and you have to have continuity there. So the wave function goes to 0 at x equals 0. So that means that psi of x is equal to 0, which is equal to A sine kx plus B cosine kx. Well, that tells you that B has to be equal to 0 because the cosine of 0 is 1. So for this whole thing to be 0, B has to be 0. So that means that psi of x is actually just equal to A times the sine of kx. Okay, we still don't know much about A or K, so let's keep going. At L, when X is equal to L, we also know that psi of X has to be 0 because it's 0 from L on. So that means 0 is equal to A times the sine of KL. That is, if we substitute in X equal to L, then we know that psi of L is 0. So 0 is equal to A times sine of KL, and that tells us, in the middle of slide 22, KL must be equal to N pi, where N is equal to 1, 2, 3, dot, 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 dot. And if you're really quick, you may look at that and go, but N could also be 0 and have this equation be true. And that's true, but if we set, if KL is equal to N pi and N is equal to 0, then that tells us that either K or L is 0. If K is 0, then psi of x is 0, and we sort of have just a, I mean, we have nothing. We have no particle there. If L is equal to 0, there's no box. So it turns out that when N is equal to 0, it doesn't really make sense. So that's why we say that the boundary condition at x equal L tells us that KL is equal to N pi, where N is equal to 1, 2, 3, etc. N is an integer. So now, where are we? That tells us at the bottom of slide 22 that psi of x is equal to A times the sine of kx, but now I've rewritten k as n pi over L, which is the, what we got from the boundary condition at L. And n is equal to 1, 2, 3, etc. And this is only good, I mean, this is good in the region 0 less than x. I'm sorry, x between 0 and L. Go to slide 23. Well, remember that hold on a second, let me get my mind around this. If you remember that we have a free particle, so if you go to slide 19, remember that we have this relationship that k squared is equal to 2me over h bar squared. So now what I want to do is to solve for e and substitute in for the k that we have, and that because k is now constrained in this problem. So if you go back down to slide 23, we know that k is n pi over L, and if we take the free particle energy and we substitute in for n pi over L, we get this expression where I have the blue B in a circle. And what you see is that when we have this periodic condition, this KL is equal to n pi, that we get by the boundary condition of x equal L, quantizes k, which quantizes the energy. So all of a sudden we have a problem where we've quantized the energy, and in fact it turns out to be a general rule in quantum mechanics. When you have an attractive potential, and by that I don't mean a beautiful looking potential, I mean one that is binding or wants to capture. If you have an attractive potential, you'll always get discrete energy states or quantized energies. So if we set n equal to 1, we get the expression on the left-hand middle of slide 23. If we get n equal to 2, we get 4 times that, etc. So this tells us something else that's sort of interesting that comes out of this quantum mechanical solution that you wouldn't see classically. Classically, I can have this particle sitting in this confined region of space, and it can have zero energy, no problem. In this quantum mechanical solution, that's not true. We have what's known as a zero-point energy, that is, this lowest energy state is not zero. So that's something sort of new. All right. So let's go to slide 24. Before we do that, let's go back to slide 22. And at slide 22, just to summarize where we are in our analysis of the wave function, using the two boundary conditions that we have talked about at x equal L and x equals 0, we have found that psi of x is equal to A times sine of n pi over L times x. What is A? Well, let's now go to slide 24. We can determine A by using the normalization condition. That is, we say the particle's in the box somewhere. The particle is somewhere. So that means that if I integrate psi square over all space, I have to be equal to 1. In this problem, the particle, the wave function, we know does not is no place except between 0 and L. So we only need to integrate psi squared between 0 and L. And I have that written on slide 24, where I have a blue A in a circle, where I've, instead of the n pi over L, I've just let it be equal to k. So psi squared turns out to be, you know, A squared times sine squared of kx. And we're integrating into one-dimensional problem, so we integrate across, along dx, and we integrate only in the region between 0 and L. A is a constant, so that pulls out. And then the integral is doable, and I'm not going to bother doing it here. In fact, it's done for you in Jean Coley, example 38.6, which in the correct version, in our fourth edition book, it's on page 1032, or at least if you have the version of the book in volumes and you're looking at volume 3, it would be on that page. It's easy enough to do the integral. It takes a little substitution. I'm not going to bother with it. At any rate, that integral is L over 2. So it turns out to be very simple. So A is simply equal to the square root of 2 over L. So I have circled in red at the bottom of slide 24 our final solution for psi. And psi is quantized. Psi is a function of x, and it's equal to the square root of 2 over L times the sine of n pi over L times x. And this exists for n equal 1, 2, 3. So this number n that is the integer that we use in the quantization would be something you would call it a quantum number. Okay, so it gives you the different states that are allowed. So let's go to slide 25. So what does this wave function look like? We now have the function itself. So on the left-hand side, above where I have the blue A in a circle, you have the wave function. I'm about to sneeze, excuse me. Okay, so it's just a sine of pi over L. In this case, the wavelength is equal to 2L. How do I know that? I know that because, remember, if we go to page 22, KL is equal to N pi. K is 2 pi over lambda. So we can determine lambda. In fact, let me take a moment and write that on here. Sorry, be with you in a second. On the left-hand side of slide 25, I just wrote how you go from KL, which is equal to n pi, to an expression for lambda. Lambda is 2L over n. So if n is equal to 1, then lambda is 2L. If n is equal to 2, lambda is L. If n is equal to 3, lambda is 2/3 L. So given that, with the how the wavelength depends on L, in red I have drawn a representation of what psi is mathematically. Now, of course, what does that represent physically? For that, we have to go to slide 26. And what we really get out of psi is if we square psi, then what we have is the probability density for seeing the particle at position x. So in the n equal 1 state, the particle, the probability of seeing the particle is represented by the curve in red. So the most probable spot for you to see the particle would be at L over 2, right in the middle. That's where you have a peak. In the n equal 2 state, you see that you have zero probability for the particle to be at the middle, but at where you have the two peaks, you have the highest probability of seeing the particle. And on n equal 3, you have a different form. So the whole probability density looks different in each of the cases. So we're going to play with this a bit more, and then talk about some of the other strange aspects of quantum mechanics. And eventually we're going to come back to looking at Schrodinger's equation for three-dimensional spherical Coulomb potential. And out of that will pop the modern model of the atom. But I think I'm going to spend some time doing some examples not so different from what we just did, solving quantum mechanics and different potentials, learning some things from that. And then I want to spend a little time talking about some of the weirder aspects of quantum mechanics and this whole idea of thinking of particles as waves. And then we'll move on to atoms. So thank you for your patience. Sorry that I have to travel so much this semester. I hope these online lectures are working okay for you. Please don't hesitate to send me emails if you have questions. If needed, I can set up a Skype phone call with you, and I will be around next week. By the time you get this, well, I may post this tonight, so if you were to look at it, this is my night. Sorry, very confusing. It is almost 9 o'clock on Tuesday, April 2nd for me. It is almost 8 in the morning for you on Tuesday, April 2nd. I am probably going to post this lecture tonight if I can. And if I do, it's possible you'll hear this lecture before I send an email with all the details on the exam. But I will try to do that very shortly. It turns out I have a meeting that I have to attend via phone in about 10 minutes. So it turns out the rest of my evening sort of fills, so I might not get that email out tonight. At any rate, I hope all is well, and I look forward to seeing you next week. Bye for now.